This is KWMR Point Reyes Station.
KWMR is supported by our listener members and by City Sewer Pumping, family-owned and operated, online at citysewerpumping.com or at their Facebook page. And additionally, I'm here to let you know that KWMR is supported by the San Geronimo Valley Community Center, online at sgvcc.org. That's sgvcc.org. And now it's time for today's episode of Epicenter. This is Epicenter on KWMR, West Marin Community Radio. Epicenter is rebroadcast Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m., featuring a wide array of community and public affairs. Today, your host is Jim Fazakerly, and I will now hand it over to him.
Three-quarters of Americans believe that the country is in the midst of a crisis of polarization. We've all been witness to its impact on responses to the pandemic and to demands for racial justice. Many observers liken our national divide to a kind of cold or soft civil war. So how do we as a country alleviate the distrust and the demonizing that erode our communities? Well, today on Epicenter, we're joined by a leader of the nonprofit organization known as the Listen First Project, dedicated to bridging the divide through a steady expansion of conversations in communities all over the U.S. Dr. Graham Bode is the Chief Listening Officer for NLP, and he joins us today by phone line this morning. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Bode, and welcome to KWMR.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Jim. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I note that with some delight that you have a new C-suite title there. I just want to, for a moment, touch on Chief Listening Officer. I'd never heard of that title before, and I thought, well, were they being tongue-in-cheek? But not at all. In my research a little bit before our conversation today, I noted that you're a professor of integrated marketing communications at the University of Mississippi, a prolific research author, and an industry consultant. So I guess my only question is, how did you find Listen First, or were you in on the ground floor?
That's a great question. I was in my academic office, plugging away on my research, and I got a call from a woman at the Wall Street Journal who was doing a story, and we get calls all the time from reporters, and so I, you know, responded to her questions, and I thought maybe I'd get a little quote, you know, in the midst of some obscure article that was, you know, buried in the middle of Section D or something like that on a Friday. And come to find out, it was the lead story in the life section one day, and it was basically a feature of my research. And somebody that runs a retail furniture store called and said he wanted me to come in and do some training for his employees. And since that, you know, before that, I'd done some consulting here and there, but that was really the opportunity that I sort of saw firsthand the power of teaching people not only to listen in their professional lives, but if they were taking over their personal lives, kind of the impact that it had on people's marriages and people's relationships. And I'd been using this term listen first, building a listen first culture in businesses. So I did some searching, and I just found this guy named Pierce Godwin who was saying the same thing, but in a way that was trying to sort of depolarize or mend our frayed social fabric. So we touched base, and we joke and say that we met on a little dating app called Twitter, but we met, and that was about 4 years ago, and we've been pretty close partners and an alliance toward trying to bring this message of inspiration and hope through listening first to understand ever since.
Well, it sounds like it was a great professional marriage, and like so many things, when a really important initiative needs to happen, it seems like it comes from all kinds of different places together. If you're just joining us this morning, my name is Jim Fazakerly. I'm the host this morning for Epicenter on KWMR. Our guest on the phone is Dr. Graham Bode, who is the Chief Listening Officer of the Listen First Project, a nonprofit dedicated to helping to bridge the differences between communities through the steady expansion of conversations. And Dr. Bode, I just, you know, would then ask you to talk a little bit about this process that is part of the Listen First Project, where you go into communities and you take what can be fairly wide divides between the participants. You know, if it really is true that in our communities we have this soft civil war going on, it seems like a tall order to get into conversations with others where we might actually be walking in the door viewing each other as combatants. Do you think that there's what kind of hill do we have to climb to get beyond that initial hostility?
Yeah, so there's a lot in that question to unpack, and so maybe I'll start where my brain tells me to start, which is first, our organization seeks to sort of organize or bring together, we call it amplification, aggregation, and alignment of all the hundreds of efforts across the country that are seeking to bridge interpersonal, you know, interpersonal bridge building efforts, basically. So 250 or so organizations are part of the Listen First Coalition, and it's really those organizations that have boots on the ground and are doing this conversation work, and some of those conversations are virtual, and some of those conversations are in person. Now, we do some of that. You know, I live in Oxford, Mississippi. Pierce lives in the Triangle region of North Carolina, so we do some work in our local communities because that's what we really believe is that much of the work that needs to be done at the local level, establishing connections and relationships in communities and neighborhoods. And so to your sort of larger point in that question, which is how do you do this, you know, that soft civil war, interestingly, the research sort of suggests that soft civil war, the studies that find people saying that we're more divided than ever and these kinds of things, which you can quibble with, you know, historically, whether we're actually more divided now than we've ever been. And there's certainly a case to be made that we're not any more or less divided now than we were 30 years ago, 50 years ago, and so forth. But that point aside, nationally, we feel pretty heated divisions and lots of animosity, and we see lots of dehumanization. At the local level, though, there's not so much that going on. Now, it doesn't mean that some communities aren't more stricken by division and so forth than others. But when we really sort of think about those people who live in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our towns and in our cities, oftentimes we are less likely to associate those relationships and those sort of attempts at bridge building. We don't see them as hostile or as sort of adverse as we do sort of the national scene. And so there is some power to going into communities and understanding. I said I was on an email thread earlier today, and he says it's interesting. You get the most ardent red and the most ardent blue in the room and talk about potholes. It's amazing how much agreement and common ground you can find. Everybody thinks potholes suck, right? So there's some issues that we're all in agreement on, and then of course there's other issues that we agree on in principle, or we have similar values, but we see different solutions to those problems. And so it really just begins first and foremost with relationships, with building trust, which we've lost in institutions and in each other. And then once we have those basic components of a relationship, if you will, and connection across sort of some, you know, outward-facing differences perhaps, we can actually start to attack those issues that we all find are important. But we can't just go in and say, hey, let's go have a conversation about gun control or abortion or whatever the hot topic of the day is. That's just not how sort of, you know, civil or you know, listen-first conversations really happen. They happen through relationship and through connection and through stories and through all kinds of different mechanisms that allow us to connect with people.
Is there a kind of a formula that you try to put forward as at least a recommendation for a stepwise movement from de-escalation or just making a comfortable conversation environment to perhaps a unified action on some issue of communal interest?
That's a great question. Yeah, so with, you know, 250 or so organizations, you can look and see different, you know, slightly different models of those conversations, whether it's, you know, branded as a living room conversation or a Braver Angels Red Blue Workshop or a debate. or a welcome table or a story circle, any one of these models, slight differences. But I do think you hit on an important point with that question, which is it's a process. It's not something that you have one conversation and you're done. It's something that you organize a series of conversations. So whether your community feels like a charrette is the go-to, which is sort of a set of community listening sessions and meetings. It's a specific, model of conversation. Or you take some of these more peace-building or conflict resolution models. But all of them, regardless of, how many meetings there are and how long they are and others, they sort of start with a set of principles or guideposts that all participants agree before they enter into the conversation. And they usually follow some, and we have our top 10 tips for a Listen First conversation on our website that draws from the larger kind of, larger bucket of conversations. So it's basic stuff like, be respectful or be open-minded, and listen for others' perspectives before you share your own, and these kind of general guidelines for that. But the specifics aren't as important as having a set of guidelines that all verbally agree to before they come into the conversation or right at the beginning of the conversation, so that you can always, if something gets out of hand or if something goes a little bit, if it feels heated, you can always point back to the guidelines and say, look, we all agreed on these guidelines, and we're going to follow those guidelines moving forward.
Right. If you're joining us, this is Epicenter this morning. I'm Jim Fazakerly, the host, and our guest today is Dr. Graham Bode. He's the chief listening officer for a national nonprofit, the Listen First Project, which is attempting to help bridge social divides through expanding conversations at the community level. And Graham, I was interested in also asking you about what kind of evidence, I know that you have voluminous research that you've done. You're essentially a research social scientist, it seems like.
Correct. Yeah.
What kind of evidence do you crave to show that there's the efficacy for this project and for even individual sessions?
What a wonderful, problem and sort of issue that practitioners, regardless of whether they do conversations or other kind of work, face. We want to believe in our method. We want to say that our method works. And anyone who does this work has, certainly some anecdotal evidence. They went in, they did it, and people, found, that it was useful. They self-reported, like, I feel good, or, yay,
right,
or whatever, whatever the
right
outcome is. And, stories of these kind of things. But then at the same time, as just one recent example, so we help run a yearly set of events called National Week of Conversation. This year it'll be April 17th through the 25th, and the kickoff event for that is going to be called America Talks. And we just got finished running a pilot for America Talks where we had, I believe, like 500 people in one-on-one conversations, one person. The theoretically the setup, although we didn't meet this for every case, but it's supposed to be one person who supported Biden and one person who supported or voted for Trump in the most recent 2020 election. And with the goal not of arguing about who won or who you should have voted for, whose policies are best, but just sort of to bridge that interpersonal sort of divide and put a person rather than a position at the establish a relationship, so we ran those, and we were really just interested in the degree to which first of all this was something that people felt as valuable, if you didn't think so before, do you think it's valuable to reach out to someone who might think differently than you politically, and do you want to do more of this kind of thing, is this something you see you could be doing tomorrow or next week or next month. And then, of course, this variable that people call affective polarization, which is the the degree to which I not only disagree with you, but I distrust you, or I dislike you, or worse. We find from research that 20% of Republicans and 15% of Democrats say that it would be better if partisans on the other side would just die. So I mean, we're at a state in our country where it's not just, you know, not just dehumanization, but death is the outcome for at least some people. Through the pilot, you know, we found about 93%. I can go back, you know, to the 93% of people, felt as it was a positive experience, had a meaningful conversation and want to do it again. Other research like America in One Room, that was run before the pandemic that literally brought 570 something people to a Marriott, I think, and had them discuss issues. There's some, you know, good, follow-up outcome research that shows that is viable. And then there's a researcher at UC Berkeley that does some stuff called deep canvassing, which is a, you know, sort of mm-hmm. trying to get people to, vote on a certain policy. And it's not, you know, you don't knock on the door and say, you know, here's why you should vote. You knock on the door and you ask questions and you listen deeply to their responses and you get them telling stories about people that might fit, you know, whatever it is the policy is you're trying to advocate for that might fit that story. And this notion of deep canvassing is also pretty good indication that if we flip the script on, you know, persuasion isn't about me trying to beat you over the head with my agenda, but rather it's trying to seek where you are and what your agenda might be and trying to fit our agendas together, at least for a moment.
I was just curious there. Do you think that from just a technical point of view that allowing a kind of space in terms of comfort and time can facilitate folks having a chance to do a narrative as opposed to just sending out a soundbite, and that leads to more understanding?
Yeah, I think if I understand the question correctly, it is really kind of flipping this speak first mentality to what we call a listen first mentality, that rather than again trying to force your agenda or, you know, and plus what we know from research is that regardless of what the message is on its face objectively, whether you find it, objectively palatable or objectively, unpalatable, mm-hmm. part of the reason that you find whatever message it is, you know, palatable or not is who is the messenger,
right.
The same message given by Biden is going to be seen as good or bad, based on, who I voted for or what I think about Biden. And similarly for Trump and similarly for anybody else, if I know that you're a Democrat, but I'm a Republican and you say something that's pretty similar to what I believe, I'm still going to think it's different than my belief because I've attached that to the other. I think there's real power in sort of de-otherizing people who think and act and look and believe and live differently than us. We have a strong relationship with an organization called Urban Confessional, and the guy that founded that, Ben Mathis, says, listen to the person, not the position. And it's that kind of mentality that can, be part of the solution. Nobody's arguing it that we can all just get together, have conversations, sing Kumbaya, and sit by the fire all night. That's not the point.
Right.
And the point isn't for me to go find new friends or anything. I mean, although that's, useful if you want to do that. But the point is that those hard conversations, those conversations that oftentimes turn to heated conflict, can be assisted through relationship building and trust building at the beginning.
Right. And I'm wondering if the groups that you're trying to recruit to these conversations, would it be more difficult to recruit the people who are at those polar ends that you talked about, the 15 percenters?
Absolutely.
How do you reach out to those folks? Because it seems like they've got the most heat to bring to the sessions and the most benefit.
Yeah, well, if you know a secret, we'd love to talk to you.
I'll work on that at the break.
it's a problem among all these organizations. So if we're honest about the organizations in this interpersonal bridge building space, they lean heavily blue in their messaging. They seem more progressive or liberal or, democratic, if you will. Drawing from, Jonathan Haidt's Moral Foundation, for instance, Republicans and Democrats, Reds and Blues, draw on different moral foundations and therefore messaging that speaks to care and compassion speaks more to Blues. It's not that Reds aren't caring and compassionate. It's mm-hmm. that this notion of seeking common ground for the better of, the betterment of the country, the types of messages that resonate along those lines are just different for people who identify with red or blue or Democrat, Republican, or Libertarian, or whatever the labels you want to put on them. So how do you reach those people that are tenacious and stuck in their own bubble and aren't going to listen to anything other than what speaks to them? I'm not sure we can reach everybody. Isn't something that necessarily will reach 100% of people. I don't know any social movement that's ever reached 100% of people. And so that's not necessarily the goal. The goal is to hit those, at this point, 11 to 20 million Americans that can begin sort of a cascade or a cataclysmic sort of push toward reaching the, more like 65 to 100 million Americans that it's going to take to really turn the ship around. And so we're seeking. We start by speaking to those that already resonate with our message, the bridge builders, if you will. And then we hope that those individuals are, convinced that they should reach out to someone that's just slightly on the bubble. And then that bubble, increases the bubble and so forth. So and that's the advantage of having 250 or so organizations working. Some work better with reds, some work better with blues, some work better with purples and other kind of, shades of colors. And some work on, race and social justice, and others work on, food insecurity. And so all these different ways of getting at bridge building, they're all necessary because they all point us toward the direction of working better together and being a stronger, republic because of it.
Right. This is Epicenter on KWMR. I'm Jim Fazakerly, hosting this morning, and my guest is Dr. Graham Bode, who is the chief listening officer for the Listen First Project, a national nonprofit looking to bridge our social divide through an expansive series of community conversations. Graham, I'm curious about if you've looked into or have seen any data regarding the difference in efficacy of face-to-face versus Zoom or virtual conversation. Is that something your project has identified?
It's a great question. Whether you're a teacher and you're wondering whether in-person classrooms or virtual classrooms are better for student learning, or you're someone like us who's trying to convene people in conversations and you're wondering whether virtual conversations can have the same power, I'm not sure there's expansive data on that. There's a growing sort of sense that we need more data to inform. It's to some extent there's some qualitative sort of differences that we can acknowledge that just isn't the same. You may have seen this video going around of Frank Luntz's focus group the night before inauguration between people who voted for Biden and people who voted for Trump, and it looks like the train went off the rails like almost at the beginning. I think there's several reasons for that. Is it because of the virtual? I'm not sure it was because of the virtual. I do think there had to be something to do with the size of that group. It was way too large, for anything productive to happen. I think they may or may not have had solid ground rules that everybody actually agreed to. The types of questions. So the problem is that, to really isolate virtual versus face-to-face, everything else has to be held constant in a true scientific sort of controlled, study. And we just don't have those sort of, we might have one or two here or there, but so many variables are conflated. So it's really hard to isolate exactly whether it's the virtualness or the in-personness that's really the power, we're left to kind of speculate, if it had been in person or it should be in person. I do think people's comfort level with virtual versus in-person conversations has something to do with it. And at the same time, we're seeing organizations across the country have really a good example in Max. And so I think there is something to be said about trying to think through how to make the best virtual conversation, and some of the variables may be slightly different. And therefore, if they are, you truly can't equate, apples to apples with virtual and in-person, because so many other variables have to be manipulated or changed or controlled for you to really pinpoint that.
Sure. It sounds like at the end of the day, though, there's positive benefits to be had regardless of the medium that you are trying to employ for the conversation. your project is how big is the organization that you're working with?
Listen First Project or the other organization?
The Listen First Project.
Listen First Project. You know, Pierce is the founder and chief executive officer. I'm the chief listening officer. We've got a social media manager and a couple of people that help with social media. And we've got somebody that works with books, films, documentaries, and tries to also help manage when we are on our big push for National Week of Conversation. And then we've got a treasurer. We've got a board of directors as well. They're more of an advisor sort of role. So, I mean, all in all, you know, we have like, well, right now we have one actual paid individual and then everybody else, including myself, volunteers, you know, sort of, you know, chalks this up as I chalk it up as service, you know, within the research, teaching and service part of my role at the university. But we're you know, a small but you know, powerful, mainly volunteer team at the present moment, although definitely looking for funding to increase our paid staff at the same time.
Right. If you were to do a little bit of crystal ball gazing, Graham, where would you like to see this organization or this campaign, let's say the year 2030?
Oh, yeah. I don't want to exist. or if I do
work your
exist,
way out of a job.
I want us to exist in a different capacity. And so, you know, you're familiar with Giving Tuesday probably, and your listeners are probably familiar with that. And very few people know that Giving Tuesday is an actual 501c3 organization that sits behind and is the infrastructure for both Giving Tuesday, which is the Tuesday after Black Friday, as well as Giving Tuesday Now, which is a day in May. You know, it was built, right? That this movement, Giving Tuesday, was built. It had an architecture and so forth. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to, you know, whether we call it the Listen First Movement or eventually it's called, we had a campaign that is sort of just now wrapping up called Weaving Community. Whether that's the hashtag and the slogan, and you know, it doesn't really matter to us. What we really care about is actual sort of, you know, social change in the mindsets and the behaviors of everyday Americans and really across the globe, getting rid of our toxic polarization, our affective depolarization, you know, our hatred, our dehumanization. And as well, we've got several organizations that work on loneliness and isolation, which really are underlying conditions of the same kind of, you know, capacity. So, you know, back to your question, you know, we want to, you know, we definitely want to exist as an organization, but we want to be kind of, you know, hopefully in the background, you know, kind of like an ad council, if you will, leading national, you know, big national campaigns around specific issues, for instance, and convening national conversations around specific, you know, community-led issues, or potentially be a grant-making organization where, you know, somebody's given us, you know, several hundred million dollars, let's imagine, and then we're able to actually, like, fund the work on the ground, because that's where the power is the people on the ground in the communities doing this work.
Okay, well, I'm afraid time has caught us, Graham, so we're going to have to sign off here. But I thank you so much for sharing with us your work, the organization's work. You're listening to Epicenter on KWMR. I'm Jim Fazakerly, and coming up will be more music and commentary.
Epicenter is a series dedicated to community and public affairs in West Marin. If you have ideas for topics, email programming@kwmr.org. Epicenter is rebroadcast at 5 p.m. every Monday through Thursday. You can stream the audio archives of Epicenter shows on our homepage, kwmr.org.